Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about the outdoors and America's public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. In just a minute, with the Trump administration attacking our parks and public lands, states are stepping up. We'll break down our new scorecard on recreation, access, and energy development. Plus, a look back at the Sutro Tunnel, an engineering marvel that started this week in Western history. But first, let's talk about the news. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is not having a great month. You've probably seen some of the stories about his travel. He keeps scheduling official trips that just happen to overlap with political events and fundraisers everywhere he goes. He flew back home to Montana twice in his first month on the job, both ostensibly official trips, one to visit Glacier National Park, which just happens to be near his home in Whitefish, then again a couple weeks later to visit Yellowstone. That Yellowstone trip included not one but two fundraisers for Montana Senator Steve Daines at the very swank Yellowstone Club in the Big Sky Resort. There was also a fundraiser for the Virgin Islands GOP in St. Croix, the RNC spring meeting at the Hotel Coronado in San Diego, a steakhouse in Alaska with Congressman Don Young, and then there was what led up to that $12,000 private plane you've probably heard about. The backstory is really what's going on here, though. Follow along with me. First, the secretary and his staff flew to a resort on Lake Tahoe, where he gave a speech to the Rule of Law Defense Fund. They support Republican attorneys general. At that dinner, Secretary Zinke sat at a table with lobbyists from Koch Industries and the NRA. The next day, Zinke and his staff flew from Tahoe to Las Vegas, where he did a photo op in Pahrump, Nevada. He signed some paperwork around PILT, payments that go to rural counties. Here's the thing, though. There's no reason to do a photo op for PILT money. The Interior Secretary has no discretion over it. It's allocated by Congress. There's certainly no need to fly all the way to Nevada to sign it, and yet that's really the only official reason he went to Nevada. So what was really going on here? Well, after that Tahoe event with the Attorneys General, Secretary Zinke dropped in at a team dinner for the Las Vegas Golden Knights NHL team. Now, the Knights are owned by a guy named Bill Foley, and Foley just happens to be Ryan Zinke's biggest fundraiser. Foley is the CEO of Fidelity National Financial, and the employees of Fidelity National and their associated companies have given Ryan Zinke just shy of $200,000. Almost all of it was for his first house race in 2014. Fidelity National employees were far and away Ryan Zinke's biggest source of campaign cash. Bill Foley also has a home in Whitefish, Montana, and a winery in Santa Barbara, where Ryan Zinke also has a home. It's safe to say that without Bill Foley, Ryan Zinke wouldn't have made it to Congress. And because of that dinner with his benefactor's hockey team, Ryan Zinke missed the last commercial flight out of Las Vegas. So he did what any of us would do. He booked a private plane for $12,000 to take him home to Whitefish, where he had a meeting the next morning. Of course, Ryan Zinke didn't pay for that flight. You did. You also paid more than $2,000 for the custom vanity coins Zinke had minted with his name and title on them so he can give them out as souvenirs. You also pay someone at the Interior Department to run up to the roof every time Ryan Zinke enters and leaves the building to fly a special secretarial flag whenever he's in the office, or as his spokesperson calls it, in garrison. Boy, you know, we'd really be in trouble if Ryan Zinke ever let this job go to his head. Let's bring in two folks from the Center for Western Priorities who you may have heard on the podcast before. Our advocacy director, Jesse Prentice Dunn.
Good afternoon.
And our outreach coordinator, Sarah Rose Tannenbaum.
Hi, everyone.
Sarah Rose and Jesse are the authors of one of the longest, most comprehensive reports that the Center for Western Priorities has ever put out. It is an 8-state scorecard looking at state policies when it comes to conservation, outdoor recreation, and responsible energy development. Let's start with the bottom line here, either one of you. Which states came out on top and which ones are at the bottom?
Both Colorado and Montana really shined and came out on top. At the bottom were Idaho and Arizona, with New Mexico, Wyoming, Nevada, and Utah falling somewhere in the middle.
And the way we scored this was a point system that you guys put together here for various policies.
Correct. I spent a lot of time talking to policy experts and local organizations in each state trying to get a sense of what would be a really fair way to compare states against one another, and also to learn what different individuals in each state were championing as far as strong policies.
Nice. So Colorado and Montana, why did they finish so high?
Sure. So before we dive into that, it's worth noting that, you know, Colorado and Montana consistently came out on top. They've got a ton of proactive conservation policies, but there were bright spots for all of the states within this scorecard, and also on the flip side, areas for improvement. So in Montana, you know, Montana's really got the gold standard for stream access. They can allow boaters to float through private property, to wade, to portage around obstacles, and they've done a ton of work to bolster their outdoor recreation economy, including establishing an Office of Outdoor Recreation recently and putting into place a state access specialist. So they've done a ton of work there. And similarly, Colorado has also done a lot to fund conservation efforts. Since 1992, they've had the Great Outdoors Colorado program and have really the first state standards for methane capture from energy development.
So at the bottom then, on the flip side, Idaho and my home state of Arizona, what stuck out there? Why were they so much lower than the other states?
I think one thing we see in those two states is a lack of consistent funding that's permanent and sustained. Each state has taken initiative to pass sort of one-time measures that fund, say, conservation, but over the course of a few years, those often can run out, and then there's no replenishing of them.
And it's worth noting in Arizona, they've got kind of an interesting case with their Arizona Heritage Fund, kind of similar to Colorado's program, take state lottery proceeds for conservation funding. But back in 2010, the state legislature stripped out part of that for the State Parks Heritage Fund, which funded a lot of proactive conservation infrastructure work, took that out and only left funding for wildlife. So that's kind of been an embattled program.
And just to round out the rest here, that left a pack of four states in the middle. We had New Mexico, Wyoming, Nevada, and Utah. And Utah there may surprise some folks, considering how much we talk about Utah's ongoing attack on public lands here on the podcast. What went into Utah's score, and what made them, despite these legislative attempts to try to roll back or even get rid of national public lands, they are in some cases doing some things right?
So you noted the big tension, the elephant in the room here, where Utah's got some of the prettiest places in America, some of the best public lands, and yet somehow their elected politicians seem to, in a unified fashion, just bash that conservation legacy. So while our report didn't dock points for those anti-public lands bills and a lot of this heated rhetoric, we did look at what state policies they had in place. So, you know, they have instituted a state office of outdoor recreation. They do have some decent access to state trust lands, even if their fish and game department has to pay for that access for hunters and fishermen. But again, it's hard to talk about what Utah is doing well without talking about how they're trying to take us backwards in conservation efforts.
But at the end of the day, this was a rubric decision to not dock points for running really awful bills that try to hurt public lands.
That's true. I think a big piece of the scorecard is finding opportunities to celebrate the initiatives that states are taking. A lot of people are doing a really amazing work on the ground that's at the local and municipal level as well, and as with nonprofits, and often in collaboration with state agencies. And given the air of the moment, we just really wanted to take a moment to celebrate that.
Sarah Rose, you've spent more time on this scorecard than anyone else here. You've traveled to many of these states in person this year. You've talked to folks on the ground in all of them. Walk us through the process that went into this scorecard of trying to take all of these various state policies and organize them in some way that we could then compare apples to apples across state lines.
That's a really good question, Aaron, because each state is different in their own way, politically, in terms of their resources, in terms of what their challenges and opportunities are. And we tried really hard to only tease out certain policies that we could fairly and compassionately judge across all eight states. And the process of doing that involved talking to policy experts who are championing various policies in each of their states and getting a sense of what they were proud of and where they thought there was room for improvement, because states have a lot to learn from one another, even though there is such variety between them.
Jesse, why now? We spend so much time this year, especially talking about President Trump and Secretary Ryan Zinke at Interior. Why turn the other way right now and instead look at what states are doing?
That's right. I think there's a lot of frustration in the West right now in terms of this administration's attacks on public lands and rolling back a lot of our conservation legacy. And historically, when either inaction at the federal level happens or steps backwards occur, that's when states can take the lead and really move the ball forward. And so we thought this was a particularly appropriate time to look at what states are doing, who is leading the way, and how other states can learn from them and move the ball forward. As folks often say, states are the laboratories of democracy.
So basically you're saying there is a leadership vacuum right now, so now's the time for states to step up when the federal government is taking a step back or even trying to pull the country backwards in terms of conservation.
I was about to say, I'm not sure it's so much of a vacuum as it is a concerted step backwards.
And I think I'll add that a lot of amazing work is happening at the local and municipal and county levels as well. And this scorecard intentionally decided to focus only on the state level, but a lot of that work happens in collaboration with nonprofits where agencies are working on the ground as well. So I just like to acknowledge that.
So ready to start up on a county by county scorecard, right?
Yeah, well, add that to the queue.
After a week of sleep.
Right. We held a phone call with reporters this week to introduce this scorecard along with some of our partners that Sarah Rose especially has worked with. Start with Nevada, because that's a really interesting story, the way Nevada ended up where it did in this scorecard.
A big part of Nevada's story is what happened actually in this last session. The state was really proud to pass some very pro-public lands measures, including an Every Kid in the Park program, which ensures free state park access to elementary school kids in grade 4. And then also they passed the Public Lands Day, which was kind of followed off of the federal model, which started in the 90s and also followed in Colorado's footsteps, who had their first Colorado Public Lands Day in the spring.
Nevada, very much a state in transition right now, heading in the right direction. Here's Andy Magi with the Nevada Conservation League.
Ultimately, Nevadans care a lot about public lands. We've seen in poll after poll that Nevadans strongly support the protection of public lands. We use our public lands. We hunt, we fish, we camp, we hike. We spend time with our families outdoors, and I think one of the really interesting things here in Nevada is when you talk to businesses in Las Vegas as they look at expanding, one of the resources they point to is that being incredibly critical is access to the parks and open spaces and public lands around Las Vegas is something that can attract talent to their businesses and help grow the economy here.
And in Montana, Jesse, we talked to Dave Chadwick up there from Montana Wildlife Federation. He had a lot of interesting things to say.
I think one of the nice things about this scorecard is the ability to compare across states and see where we have those great policy opportunities that states can borrow from each other. Because I think as we see sort of increasing dysfunction at the federal level, it's really up to us to protect our outdoor opportunities. And so the more opportunity we have to innovate and to share innovations across Western states is just going to become even more crucial to the extent that we just can't rely on the federal government to take care of these resources for us.
You know, Montana is really an outdoors lover's paradise, you know, from Glacier National Park to a ton of national forests and BLM land. There's a lot to do there, and the state has really advanced that legacy, particularly in terms of accessing those lands. They have a ton of programs to help people that want to use the lands access them, you know, across private property and elsewise. I mentioned earlier they have great stream access laws, and they've taken a ton of steps recently to boost their outdoor recreation economy.
Sarah Rose, what's the next step here? Obviously, we joke about county policies, but you bring up a good point that there's more to this story than just state-level policies and laws. This was a huge months-long research effort on your part. Are there topics or areas or even states that you would like to include next if we get to revisit this scorecard in a year or two?
Something that didn't end up making it into this scorecard was the topic of how do we revitalize our rural economies that are struggling as they transition from largely fossil fuel-based economies. And in researching that, I came across lots of amazing and innovative programs that involve funding, that involve serious intentional planning on the part of state or also local agencies to kind of vision what the path forward may be.
And I'd say one thing that goes hand in hand with that, we did a lot to look at policies relating to oil and gas and coal development. But I think when we're talking about revitalizing rural economies, you can't talk about that without talking about renewable energy and a lot of the training programs that come with it and interesting partnerships. So certainly something worth looking into.
So a whole other possibly economic section that's still to be teased out here. We're an advocacy organization, and Jesse, you are our advocacy director. What do you hope comes out of this report? What are the actionable steps?
So I think our hope was really to start a conversation about where states are doing well and where they can improve. And as a lot of these Western states head into their next legislative session, I think this is a useful conversation to have. And so my hope is that people understand where their strong suits are and look to make leaps in some of these key areas.
Sarah Rose Tannenbaum, Jesse Prentice Dunn, congratulations on this scorecard. As I've been saying, it was a long, heavy lift for both of you, and much congratulations on getting that out the door. And thank you both for taking the time today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Aaron.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was 148 years ago when construction started on the Sutro Tunnel in Nevada. 10 years prior, prospectors had discovered the Comstock Lode, and it quickly led to the most intensive gold and silver mining activity in the West. But the mining companies had to pump water all the way up to the surface to keep digging. That's where engineer Adolph Sutro comes in. In 1860, he proposed a 6-mile-long tunnel through the Comstock Lode to drain water horizontally rather than having to pump it vertically. He got approval in 1865 and started selling stock to raise money for the tunnel's construction. That started in 1869, and it was completed 9 years later, slowed down thanks to resistance from the mining companies that worried Sutro might use his tunnel to take control of the entire Comstock Lode. So by the time the tunnel was complete, the richer sections of the Comstock had already been mined, but the tunnel worked as advertised. It drained 2 million gallons of water every year. Despite the declining production, Adolph Sutro still managed to sell his tunnel at a huge profit, apparently made about $1 million, moved to San Francisco, used all that money to become one of the city's biggest landowners, and later, briefly, mayor. The Sutro Tunnel is still around, but it's on private property and usually not open to the public. But there are tours happening at an event coming up on November 16th, so if you're in Nevada, check that out. The Sutro Tunnel, where construction started this week in 1869. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. As always, send your love letters and hate mail to podcast@westernpriorities.org. Thanks again to Jesse and Sarah Rose for digging into their state scorecard with us. You'll find a link to that in the show notes. We'll be back in a week or two with a look at forests in the West and the East, a really interesting discussion about trees, overpopulation of deer, and what happens when predators leave an ecosystem. I'm Aaron Weiss. On behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.